Namo Buddhaya.
Jai Bhim.
So we've been looking at how you become a bodhisattva. And I've given you some guidance, I hope, some useful guidance as to how you become a bodhisattva. But I now have to admit that I've been completely deceiving you. There's no possibility of you or me becoming a bodhisattva. I was just filling up the time. It's completely impossible. If you think of me becoming a bodhisattva, no bodhisattva will be become. That's the truth of it. It's a way we sort of have to talk, because you have to exercise your sense of I in order to go beyond I. So you sort of do have to think of I becoming a bodhisattva. It won't just happen. But at the same time, if you start thinking about being a bodhisattva, well, you're going to become the very opposite of a bodhisattva. You're going to become, a self-deluded person, deluded with the idea of being such a good bodhisattva. So does that mean that we just forget it and pack up and go home? It's a possibility. Just ignore the whole thing and put it down to experience. You get deluded and pay good money to waste your time. Well, no, I'm afraid it's not as simple as that. You can't think of being a bodhisattva. And I think it's especially important for us in the modern cultures that are increasingly spreading all over the world, cultures in which there's a tremendous emphasis on the consumer, if you like, the consumer of experience. The isolated individual, what Bhante would refer to as the individualist. There's a very strong emphasis on I and me separate from everything else. And our economy, our technology, our society, increasingly, and Britain actually is really rather extreme in this way, I think, relative to many other even Western nations. A very strong retreat from a sense of belonging, a sense of community, and a retreat increasingly into an isolated individuality, individualism. I think that the efficiency of our consumer society accentuates that. I think that the early signs of what the internet does is to isolate people whilst giving them a simulacrum of social engagement. Of course, it's not entirely a simulacrum. It does to some extent, but it's increasingly superficial. So I think that the whole trend of the cultures that most of us come from is towards individualism. I see it in India. I see it racing in India. When I first went out, it was very much a traditional society. And Vivekananda Ratna must be very aware of this. But increasingly people are seeing themselves isolated from their collective background. And there are some gains from this. Because, of course, the collective can be very cramping, very confining. And can be, well, very much what we refer to as a group, which it's difficult to escape from. So there are definitely gains from the trends that have been developing in Europe and other countries connected with Europe, really since the European Enlightenment. The European Enlightenment is very much the release of the individual in the best and the worst senses. So I think it's a great danger of modern Buddhism that it plays to a kind of consumerist notion of spirituality. And it's very much connected with the idea that through spiritual life we can get something that we can have something. As Bhante said, sometimes when people talk about enlightenment or insight, something like that, it's as if they're talking about something they can pluck and put on their in their buttonhole, but they remain essentially unchanged. So we need to be very much conscious that Dhamma life is not like that. It's not something that decorates your selfhood. It's not a trophy to add to your selfhood. It's not the apotheosis of your selfhood. The Dhamma life is the complete leaving behind of your self-identification. And whilst we have to use self to end self, we have to be careful that the way in which we do so does not merely accentuate self. Do you see what I mean? It's a very important point, and I've only sketched it in, but perhaps I've given you the pith idea of it, and it's enough. And very much the antidote to that is belonging to a spiritual community. The antidote to that sense of separate selfhood is belonging to Sangha, seeing oneself as part of Sangha, as contributing to Sangha, as participating in Sangha, belonging to Sangha, and seeing that your own life is inextricably bound up with the life of the Sangha to which you belong. Reflecting on my own life in this respect, and I've been ordained now for 44 years. It's amazing, isn't it? I didn't think people even lived that long. And I've been engaged with the order, forget it, almost 50 years. I think how fortunate I am that throughout my life I've had a context. I've had a setting in which my own qualities can be given and worked out and developed, and a context within which my weaknesses, my failures, my inadequacies are not too dominant, because others who I'm closely working with compensate for them, if you see what I mean. I'm so fortunate. Many people do not do this. They seek community, often through family, but often that is not so easy, and often people process through various families, and although something of community is gained from that, it's often not, it's not completely satisfying and fulfilling. So I feel extremely fortunate that my life has been lived within a context which I deeply believe in, and which can sustain my own development, my own evolution. Bhante speaks of this very powerfully by saying that the bodhicitta is not to be thought of as something that the individual attains. And he thinks that the bodhicitta is most likely to arise in a community of people living and working closely together. People sharing life very, very intensely, and sharing a goal, an ideal, very, very deeply, so that they give themselves up to the collective goals and purposes and activity, so that you see your own life as contributing to something, and you don't think of what's achieved as sort of narrowly yours. I've found this working in teams. I remember that very much with the team that we formed first here at Padmaloka when we began the new phase of the men's ordination process. We had a really, really top team, a crack team. Surita, where is he? He was there. Suvadra, Sona, Padmavadra, a little bit later, you know, a few months, and Chittapala, Aloka, a really wonderful team. And the very strong sense that what we were achieving wasn't achieved by any individual. was our collective activity. And we each had our own strengths and our own weaknesses. For instance, I remember discussing Mitras. I don't know whether you realise this, but we discuss you. I remember the discussions. You know, people like me who are very, very clever, I would have a lot to say and analysis and, you know, suggestions and so forth. And then it would come round to Surata. And Surata would say, I don't know. Doesn't taste right. And we'd say, Surata, tell us what you wish. But he was usually right. He was usually right. Well, yeah, he tastes right. All Danian. Is he still like that? Is he still like that? Yeah, he's still like that. I thought he would be.
The metaphor is not cooked.
Not cooked. And the thing is, we all realised in the end, Surata is much more perspicacious than the rest of us. He's also theoretical. But for Surata, it was absolutely immediate. He could feel it and see it. And we quickly learned that the one we thought was rather dim, actually, at the beginning, we realised was actually the most sensible and wise of us all. Anyway, you get my point. Flattery. Get me anywhere. But joking apart, and I'm not entirely joking either, you get what I mean, that each of us brings certain strengths, certain weaknesses to the team. And if the team is really functioning well, if some touch, something like bodhicitta, something that's more than the individual, is really alive, then what you bring to it, what's good in what you bring to it, is used and is enriches what we all have, and what you're not so good in is sort of compensated for or made up for or balanced, so that the team becomes more than the individual. And if the team is working in the context of the bodhisattva ideal, for the bodhicitta, then it can really manifest amongst you. Just moments when you realise that the team is no longer individuals, it's more like fingers on a hand. They all work together to a common purpose. And it's not that any individual loses their individuality, or that they become a group. They become something more than that. So what this really leads on to say is that the way in which we overcome the tendency to try to be a bodhisattva is by participating together in the order, we try to, as it were, contribute to the order as a bodhisattva. Bhante expresses this mythically, symbolically, by saying that the order is the manifestation of the thousand-armed, 11-headed Avalokiteshvara. And he says that we should think of this literally. Whether he means literally, metaphorically or not is another question. But he means that we shouldn't merely think of it as a sort of polite figure of speech. It's an attempt to express in poetic, symbolic form, a deep, deep truth. The order, he says, emerged because of him, but through him. He doesn't feel that he created the order. In responding to the situation that he found himself in, he found the order emerging. I said the other day that he told me he didn't have a real plan. He didn't mean to found the order. I remember when I first went into a centre, the centre in 14 Monmouth Street. Some of you may have seen it from the outside. There was a notice up on the board about the order. And I won't go into the details, but quite a different outline of what the order was than what it actually is now. For instance, there were levels of ordination, and so on. So what the order is now, as we know it, is something that emerged as Bhante's understanding unfolded, and as we responded to him. As the order emerged, so the order emerged, if you see what I mean. It was something that dictated its own direction, because Bhante was sufficiently imbued with the spirit of the bodhicitta and was able, therefore, to respond to situations in ways that allowed bodhicitta to manifest as the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara in thousand-armed, eleven-headed form. It's easy to say all this, and easy perhaps to seize upon it in too superficial a way, and easy maybe to dismiss it and to literalize it. But it's a very, very deep truth about what we are and why we're gathered in this that I hope you can begin to relate to. The order is the manifestation of the bodhicitta. This doesn't mean that Bhante is perfect or that he perfectly manifested. We know there have been complications, but that is not inconsistent with manifesting the bodhicitta, if you see what I mean. And often the problems are not the problems that people think they are, if you see what I mean. So bodhicitta is the inspiration which has manifested in the order. When we participate in the order, we're contributing to the greater manifestation of that bodhicitta. We're trying to make the thousand-armed, or allow the thousand-armed, 11-headed Avalokiteshvara to manifest more and more richly and fully and perfectly. It will never be completely perfect, because this subluminary level is by nature imperfect, and we are certainly imperfect. So it manifests through us and through our interaction with each other. But the more it manifests through our interaction with each other, the less our individual imperfections and quirks of personality and so forth will contaminate it or will pollute it. So it's our participation in the order that is the most profound of our ways of connecting with bodhicitta. Of course, we do need to do our visualization practice, our imagination practice, and try to connect with bodhicitta through our own personal meditation practice. We do need to work on ourselves and use the reactions that manifest our self-clinging in order to go beyond them. We need to do that work. It's an active business, participation in the order. But above all, we need to participate in the order. We need to work with other order members. We need to see our contribution to the world, as we talked about yesterday, trying to manifest bodhicitta in the world through our active life in the world. We need to see that as part of a larger collective enterprise, to put it that way. And we need to feel that the order is our primary social context, social in the largest, well, broadest sense of the term social. So I want to explore all this a bit more today, because I think we don't always understand fully in what sense the order manifests the bodhicitta, and therefore we don't understand fully how we can help it to do so better, more adequately. And this is why, of course, at times we get very disillusioned. I've been very disillusioned myself at times and feel, well, it's not up to scratch. And you will find that when you join the order. You'll be disappointed. Not forever, not always, and not in every respect. And usually what it means is you haven't understood deeply enough what the manifestation of bodhicitta means. And your disillusionment needs to be turned into a deeper understanding, a deeper reaching for the bodhicitta as it manifests amongst us. Because it does. It really does. I can say that with complete confidence from my own experience, to the extent that I'm able to experience. But I want to give you some theoretical basis for understanding this, and I'm going to start with some models which you are familiar with, and so I'm going to ask the revealers of hidden truths to unveil those hidden truths. I appear to be one of them. Gaze and wonder. The truth is there. Yes, yes, the suitable sounds. So, if you like, what the order is, the intermediary between bodhicitta and the world, to put it very simply. That's what we try to do, is to be a bridge from the world to the bodhicitta, to the bodhisattva. We try to cover all the levels, or relate through all the levels, to give an opportunity to rise up through all the levels, and we try to reach down through all the levels. So I'm just going to refresh your memories, insofar as you've got any. No, I didn't mean to say it like that. Insofar as you know of this schema, I call them the three orders of consciousness. You remember this? The group, the individual, and the Bhante calls it a third order of consciousness, which we'll look at a bit in a moment. So I think it's important to think of these as types of consciousness. Group consciousness is a way of understanding your experience in terms of your survival. Essentially, what group consciousness is about is surviving and looking to the social field for those who will stand with you in your survival, looking for your group, people like you who belong to your family, your society, your clan, your caste, your nation, whatever it is, those who will stand with you against them, whoever they may be. So the group member, and we're all group members to some extent, walks into a situation and, without even thinking about it, starts to experience the field in terms of group. Who are part of my group? Who are not part of my group? It's the sort of thing that you see very easily with other cultures. I see it very easily in India. When Indians walk into a social situation, they immediately, by some strange kind of radar, begin to identify who are apne log, our people. And it's even a common expression in Marathi, apne log. Hamare log, our people. Our people means our caste mates. Or who are part of Hamare Samaj, our society. It always defeats me because, you know, even in class-ridden Britain, you think of society as being everybody. But in India, society means your caste. Yeah? I'm only talking about Indians because it's so transparent because of the nature of caste. It's exactly the same as we all do in different ways. But Indians inevitably, immediately identify who are our people, who are not. I remember once going through emigration at Delhi airport, and there's long queues, and I noticed the queue that I was in had got, you know, really backed up, really delayed. And the guy that was there was chatting away with the emigration officer, and when I finally got to the counter, I heard him talking to the next immigration officer, saying, he's one of our people, one of his caste mates. And, you know, even in the emigration queue, he identified somebody who's one of his caste and, well, stopped the whole queue. Didn't know him, but his name gave the game away. So we all do this in one way or another. You know, I remember growing up in Britain, accents. You can tell whether people went to, you know, a good school or not. by their accent. And I don't know who teaches you, but somewhere along the line you learn to identify people's class. Of course, race is so obvious, but every country, every nation, every culture has its in-groups and its out-groups. It's natural to us because it's part of our animal nature. It's inherited from our survival instinct to seek our herd. But it's a way of seeing. This is why I think it's important to think of it as a consciousness. The consciousness that identifies our people, my people. And of course, if we are to practice the Dhamma, we need to emerge from that, because the group puts the group consciousness puts the group before everything else. So your own thinking, your own interests, and so forth are subordinated to the group. So you'll want to do whatever the group will accept. Again, easy to draw in instances from India, but so often people will say to me, well, I'm not against my daughter marrying somebody from another caste, but my relatives, they weren't allowed. And it gives the game away. That's what it's about. It's about fitting in, being accepted. And quite understandable. Life is dangerous. It's pretty difficult in India if you don't have a context to belong to. Actually, it's difficult everywhere. So we try to identify our people. So you get these internet bubbles, don't you? What do they call them? Bubbles, yes. Where you basically only talk to people who have the same interests, tastes, politics, and so forth as yourself. And you can really believe that the whole world's like that. I sometimes see that, you know, people will say something like, well, everybody thinks this. What you mean is everybody in my Facebook circle, as it were. And you just don't see the next circle. I saw an analysis recently of of political books being published in America the last since Trump's election, and apparently there the readership has become so sectionalized that nobody will read something from the the Democratic camp from the Republican camp, and vice versa. So you never get any real political discourse. So we've got an increasing sort of group faction growing, I think, in all our cultures because of the way the internet works. What's going to happen from that, I don't know. It's always been like that, but it's much more accentuated. So consciousness, the way the world actually presents itself to us is determined by this need to identify my people who will aid me in my survival. So there's a vital transition from group consciousness to individual consciousness. Individual consciousness is, I believe, best thought of in terms of karma. The individual thinks in terms of karma. Maybe not explicitly so, not expressly so, but the individual takes responsibility. And the individual replaces survival, group survival, group adaptation, group acceptance. It's a very important thing in the group, is acceptance by the group. Quite understandable. The individual thinks rather in terms of value, values, ethical, even spiritual values, aesthetic values, and those values are to be determined not by what the group says is valuable, but by what is found to be valuable. That's the key transition. The individual is the one who takes responsibility for his or her own ethical conduct, takes responsibility for his or her own thoughts and understanding, and takes especially a stand on values. And of course, we think of the individual in contradistinction to the group, because sometimes those values set one against the group and mean that one is risking thinking and speaking and acting in ways that the group does not approve of. Dr. Ambedkar famously said that it's very difficult to be a Buddhist, which is extraordinary that he said this, and he gave the religion of Buddhism to the poorest and most illiterate people in India. Such is the measure of his confidence in his people. But he said that Buddhism is a religion very difficult to practice, first of all because you have to actually practice it. You need to make an effort. It's not enough just to belong. But he said that to be a Buddhist, you have to be prepared to stand alone. In other words, you have to be an individual. But an individual we think of as sort of standing out from the crowd, standing separate from the crowd. There was a famous Mitrata in the old days, the good old days. There used to be a monthly magazine, quarterly magazine, published called Mitrata, which was very, very good material in it. But I remember there was one on the individual, the group, and the spiritual community. And it had a picture of a group which was all in sort of blurred, a group that was all in blurred. And in the middle of it, there was one sharply focused figure. It was Surata, actually. I mean, very good example. But it made the point, you know, but the message you get is the individual sort of isolated, separate. But that can be rather misleading. And it can easily then lead into individualism, which is simply a form of a supergroupism, if it's where. It's where you are the most dominant member of the group. So what you want is what the group does, or the leader of the pack, as it were, the opinion former, the former of fashion. But the individual is only isolated in respect of the group, and in respect of taking possession of his or her own ethical and spiritual and aesthetic responsibility. And the individual, if they are so fortunate, is the material of the spiritual community. Because the spiritual community consists of individuals who recognize each other. So individual consciousness is about values and about ethical responsibility. Sangha, spiritual community consciousness, the consciousness of Sangha, what Bhante calls the third order of consciousness, and he uses, for our Russian friend, the term sobornosh, if I pronounce that correctly, which is a term from Orthodox theology, which means the collegiality, I think, is often the term that translates it, which is the each of the Orthodox churches is autocephalous. It has no primate in the sense of the Pope. But they are all in communion. Bhante uses that as a term to express a higher quality. And apparently in Orthodox theology it's used in that sort of way for the angelic communion. So it's an order of consciousness where you experience a deep coincidence of wills, and a favourite phrase of Bhante's. You sense that you're all individuals, but you coincide in your understanding of where value lies. And you feel, you don't just think of this theoretically, you feel it very deeply. You feel a deep coincidence of wills, that you are, as it were, united in your what it is that you believe is most significant, most important. And it finds its highest manifestation when individuals go for refuge to the three jewels effectively, even more so when they go for refuge really. When their coincidence is beyond even a coincidence of wills, it's a coincidence in cooperation with deep suprapersonal forces working within them. So the spiritual community, the third order of consciousness, manifests or enables bodhicitta to function within it. When individuals come together in spiritual community by recognizing their shared commitment, their shared going for refuge, in our Buddhist expression, to the three jewels, then the bodhicitta can flow amongst them, through them, from them. It can carry them higher, and it can flow out to all. So this schema of consciousness is extremely important in us understanding our task, because the order and the movement which the order manifests is the attempt to connect, as it were, through all these levels, and to create a flow up through them and a flow down outwards from them. I want to illustrate this by another model, another diagram, which in a way is a sort of anatomy of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, 11-headed thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. If you imagine Avalokiteshvara with all those arms spread all around, and then the arms that are folded into the center in salutation, holding the bodhicitta, there's usually a gem in those folded hands, which represents the bodhicitta as the heart of Avalokiteshvara, and then those arms that reach out. But you must think of those arms reaching out and then pulling in, as it were. So there's a sort of movement out and in, a breathing out, a breathing in. And it's by our participating in that movement out and in, that we become part of the bodhisattva, and we participate in the bodhicitta. And we enable the bodhicitta to transform us and to transform the world. So if we can reveal the next terma, we can see this expressed in a very elegant drawing, which I hope you can all see clearly enough, but it's quite a simple one in a way. So we've got these concentric circles, which represent, if you like, the dimensions of Avalokiteshvara's reaching out and pulling in. At the heart, we've got the bodhicitta. We've got the jewel in the salutation of Avalokiteshvara. And right at the outside, we've got the group. We've got all those, which is sometimes us, because we move up and down within this. It's not a static thing. At the outside level, we've got those who are purely members of the group. Is anybody ever purely members of the group? But the analysis has to be a little bit sharp, as all analyses are, and therefore sometimes a little Procrustean, cutting off arms and legs that don't fit. But take it, you know, as a model, and don't get over-literal about it. But the group is the world. It's what surrounds us. Those who are principally concerned with their own happiness and well-being, fair enough, and who see the social environment as an environment that will assist and support and protect them in their survival. Again, fair enough. It's quite a natural thing. It's not sort of evil, although it can become evil, but it is quite restrictive. Very often is very restrictive. I mean, we have nowadays this perverse picture of a group which puts on the simulacrum of individuality, if you see what I mean. We have the style of individuality. So you get lovely things like wearing ripped jeans. Used to be a sort of a bohemian thing, which was to do really with giving up material possessions. But now you can buy an extremely expensive pair of pre-ripped jeans. I remember when I first went to the States in 67. Yes, I was there in San Francisco in 1967. I did wear flowers in my hair. And I saw Jimi Hendrix. Anyway, I'll just stop. You suddenly saw black people wearing their hats, their baseball hats, the wrong way round. And clearly it was an expression of, up yours sort of thing, to use the technical term for it. It was a gesture of defiance, and especially of rejection of the American baseball hat with your team on it. So it was a gesture, I don't belong to that. A sort of individuality. But, it didn't take long for that to become then a kind of fashion thing. And everybody does it. And you've seen it spreading in America now, in India now. Where actually you need the shade on the front of your hat, but you don't need it on the back of your neck, especially if you've got skin that's adapted to the heat. But we've got a style of individuality without the substance of it. So the group is the world. It's most people who understandably, in a way, justifiably, concerned with their own survival, don't like to speak out of turn, want to fit in, want to be accepted. There's very, very powerful force within us to be accepted. Very powerful. Why it's so difficult to speak up sometimes in a group situation. We don't want to upset people. We don't want to be rejected. That's where we've all come from. It's probably where we spend quite a bit of our time, actually, when it's all said and done, let's be honest. Because we're never, we're amphibious, so to speak. We're sometimes moving inwards towards the centre, and we're quite often standing outside. For quite a long time, that up and down process will be going on. But we try. When we come across Buddhism, we begin to feel ourselves standing more and more for values. We begin to try to stand up as an individual for what we really believe in. That often happens, first of all, while we're still group members, but we come under the influence of values. We may even adopt those values more like group badges than, as it were, from our own beliefs and heart. In India is a much more traditional society, so it's easier to see these things. But, there are many, many people who are Buddhists in India, millions of people who are Buddhists in India. But as Vivekaratna illustrated himself in his presentation, Buddhist in name only. They fly the Buddhist flag. They cheer when the Buddhism, as it were, wins, and so on. They're all for Buddhism. That's their group identity. I am a Buddhist is pretty much the same as saying I am a this or a that, a member of this group or that group. It's okay. It's the level at which it starts. What I call identity Buddhism. And it's a good identity because it actually means that you're an individual. You're a human being. It's a big move. I think one shouldn't underestimate that when you talk to being a Buddhist in name only. Actually, it's not in name only. Being a Buddhist in name only is more than being a Buddhist in name only because it means you're not a subhuman. You're a human being. So being a Buddhist for an Indian is a claiming of humanity. And that's a very important step. But it's done by and large on a group basis. But it means you're in some sort of relationship with the Buddha, with Baba Saheb, and if you're very fortunate, with those who are more deeply committed. And what we try to do in our order and movement is form a positive group. It's a group, but it's influenced by the values of the community, of the spiritual community. It's not to be decried. It's what, in our old way of thinking, we call that the friend, as it were. Of course, it's never that simple. What brings people to a Buddhist centre is usually some degree of individual aspiration. So certainly in the West, it's never that simple. In India, it's much more clear. Often people just come because their mother or father come. or because their husband or wife comes. And they just come because, well, that's their group. So they come to their group's gathering. But it's great. It's fantastic. It's wonderful. Because it means they are in contact with a positive ethical and spiritual influence. So, in a way, we need more of a positive group. We need to develop a positive group. Our centres in the West are usually far too narrow at the base, as it were. There's, you know, maybe quite a high pinnacle, but quite a thin base to the pyramid. And really, ideally, the pyramid would be a very large indeed. It would be as large as the spiritual community can influence. And I think it's to be looked for that our families begin to engage, begin to get much more of that in our order and movement, certainly in Britain, that more people bring their wife or their husband or their children, and, you know, maybe they'll never become Buddhists, but, you know, they get a positive impression and a positive feeling, get some good values from it. I think that's very much to be looked for, that we have an immediate circle around us of people who are influenced by the positive values that we have in a way sort of dilute form, if you see what I mean. They don't have to be, you know, you've got to go forth and renounce everything. It's not going to work. But, you know, we should be a bit better. We should try to practice the precepts and so forth. We think of this is cultural going for refuge, what Bhante calls cultural going for refuge. It's a very, very important intermediary between the group and the spiritual community. The positive group, if the spiritual community is at all alive, will naturally form a positive group. And probably all of us are still parts of that at times, and have probably come to some extent from that. And it's okay, it's good. It's good insofar as it's a positive group, and a positive group is a lot better than a negative group. So you're accessible to positive values. It's not so simple in our modern culture because there's so many other influences, some of which are very positive. But ideally, the spiritual community would have around it a positive group, which would have some depth and breadth. And from that, people will begin to pick up an individual connection with the Dhamma. This is an idealized way of speaking about what's happening. And so we begin to make those principles personal, begin to see them as their own. In a way, I think you saw this quite well illustrated in Vivekaratna's life, that, you know, to begin with, it's a Buddhist in name only, but you begin to think, well, yes, but what is it to be a Buddhist? How do I find it? Where do I get it from? And then, fortunately, he met Padmavajra. It's a very interesting story. I mean, in a way, Padmavajra didn't know what he was doing. No idea what he was doing. But it was a manifestation of the process that we're talking about. A hand of Avalokiteshvara reaching out. So you begin to move into the provisional Sangha. And, you know, in a rather sort of blunt way, this is what the Mitra level is supposed to indicate. Of course, it's never that simple, and, you know, sometimes the Mitra level is more like the positive group, and sometimes it's more like the spiritual community. But it's the, you know, it's a loose way of thinking about the gradations that we need to put in place for our Sangha to be really effective manifestation of the Bodhicitta. From the provisional Sangha, people begin to be able to commit themselves, as individuals, to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. They get to the point where they can go for refuge to the three jewels, the point at which they can really commit themselves to the Bodhisattva ideal. In your public ordination, when it comes, you will at the end say the four ordination vows, which express your acceptance of the ordination. And one of the things you will say is, for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. It's the Bodhisattva vow. We all took it. I didn't know what I was doing, but I did. Actually, I was so moved when I said those words. I've never heard them before. And I found myself saying them, and I thought, yes, So at the level of effective Sangha, you effectively take on the Bodhisattva ideal. You effectively take on the struggle to arouse the bodhicitta, and you effectively commit yourself to participation in the life of the order, which is the life of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. You play your part in it. You take your place in it. And of course, from the effective Sangha, the real Sangha emerges. We don't think this is something we should think about too much, because it gets terribly grabby. So we don't have a special case for the Arya Sangha. Thank goodness. Who would be the ordination team for that? Some people think we should, but that's another question. We just let that arise. No need to think about it. And what we find is that actually, even as an member of the effective Sangha, as an order member, sometimes you're right out in the group, to be frank. Sometimes you all know that the order behaves like a group, or order members behave like a group. You've all seen it. Let's be honest. Sometimes it's something a bit more like provisional, and sometimes it's effective. Sometimes, for just a little while, something real flowers. And you just lose a sense of I in a way that means you don't lose a sense of self-awareness. I've experienced this a number of times in order situations, especially on order conventions in pujas. Suddenly something happens and you no longer know who's speaking, if you see what I mean. Which doesn't mean you've lost your sense of speaking. I've experienced that at one of the most powerful occasions quite recently at a gathering of the Public Preceptors College, where my retirement was being celebrated. I don't mean they were celebrating the fact that I was retired. I mean they were celebrating my life in the college. Maybe they were, I don't know, but they disguised it very well. People were rejoicing in my merits, and it was particularly sort of pleasing and moving, because people were talking about the effect their communication with me had had on them. And as they talked, I sensed not just me, but everybody, we were losing our sense of our separateness, and that I realized we participated in something that was beyond any of us as individuals. And I realized that I could never be parted from these people. I spoke to Bhante about it later and said that I felt that the connection that I had with those people, and really with all order members, is beyond time. That I know that I will be with them again and again. And he said, well, yes, I feel that too. So we oscillate up and down. We're sometimes at our best, and we can touch on that. Sometimes we're, just even the worst kind of group member. Well, not the very worst, but pretty bad. But hopefully the balance should be up there towards the middle, and we should be generally moving in that direction. That's what one's looking for. I say sometimes the order is a Sangha and sometimes it's not. I think it's better to think like that than to think that the order is, as it were, by definition, all the time, a spiritual community. It's that order members are committed to living as a spiritual community, and quite often they manage it. That might be the best way of thinking of it. But of course, right at the heart of it all is the bodhicitta, a point at which the Sangha flowers most fully. But you can say that the Sangha itself is indistinguishable from bodhicitta. It is indistinguishable from the bodhisattva. So there's a movement inwards, a movement that all of us are participating in. We're all participating in moving from the group, which was all where we all come from. And we're moving in towards the centre of the mandala, towards the centre of the circles of Sangha, doing our best to move inwards, in harmony with others, by participating together in this process. But it's not merely a process of going in, because of the nature of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta naturally reaches out. So we're also participating in reaching out. Actually, thinking about, I just embarrassed Padmavajra having embarrassed Surata. But, you know, when he was talking about, or rather when Vivekaratna, he was talking about, you know, Vivekaratna and connecting with Vivekaratna. And afterwards he said something to me like, I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was doing. And yet, look what he's done. He connected this wonderful man with our Sangha, who's then given so much to others. But actually, Padmavajra hadn't a clue what he was doing, and probably found it really rather difficult and rather painful at times. But look what he did, because he was part of something much greater. At that time, of course, Bhante was, who you know, certainly still, to my mind, manifests the heart of the matter to far greater than anybody else I know. At that time, we were all very, very much in contact with him. It was Bhante who suggested he went out. Bhante, who he kept in contact with. But now that's become something much fuller, much richer. It's a far larger manifestation of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, with many, many more hands, many, many more arms, and many, many more people are reached. You can see that process. Bhante reached, Buddhadasa. Buddhadasa reached Padmavajra. Padmavajra reached Vivekaratna. Vivekaratna reached Ratnakumar, who you all saw here last year. And so it goes. Ratnakumar himself, I know, he's in contact with people who are coming up to ordination. So it goes, so it goes. Even though Padmavajra was struggling in his own spiritual life, struggling to get up this towards the centre, struggling and sometimes falling miserably on the flat of his face, but still struggling. I'm not saying anything different from what I've done. Struggling inwards, but at the same time reaching outwards. And that is what it is to participate in the life of the Bodhisattva. That's the nearest we can think of being a Bodhisattva. We can think of participating in a Bodhisattva activity with our brothers and sisters, contributing ourselves to it, both in a sense of moving in to try to realize more fully what's at its heart. Because if that heart is not constantly refreshed, it will die. But at the same time, reaching out to see that we can meet more and more people and draw them in. And trying to make the pathways as sort of smooth and natural as we possibly can, so that people almost don't notice they're moving in. It's so natural. The next step is there. The next step is there. I'm the president of the LBC, and I've often said to the team there, who are very, very good indeed, that they need to constantly be making sure that for everybody coming to the centre, the next step is obvious. If they want to take it, it shouldn't be hard for them to see what they next do. It should be walking up to a door and it opens. Walking up to a door and it opens. And of course, if there are barriers, there'll be internal barriers. So those barriers will be, a hand will be helping them to open those internal doors. That's what we aspire to, a completely seamless movement in and out, in and out. We aspire to it. We'll never achieve it, because the Bodhisattva, the true Bodhisattva, exists on a plane of unconditioned, where the imperfections of the conditioned don't exist. The conditioned is in principle imperfectible. Its perfectibility only lies in seeing what it really is. So we have to work on that level, but with our roots in the unconditioned, in the bodhicitta. So the order that you wish to join is essentially a bodhisattva, aspires to be a bodhisattva, and in asking to join it, You are saying you want to be part of that process. You don't want just to do your own spiritual development. You do want to develop spiritually, but only so that you can participate more and more effectively in the life of the Bodhisattva. And you want to contribute to that life of the Bodhisattva actively. It doesn't mean anything in particular. You may teach a class. Well, you may be a GP. You may be many other things. You may be, you know, for instance, if you have a family, you're trying to do your family in the spirit of the bodhicitta. Whatever you do, you're trying to do it in the spirit of the activity of the order. It'll be more or less hard, depending on what it is and depending on who you are and how effective the order that you're immediately in contact with. But in principle, everything you do should be suffused with the spirit of the order. And the spirit of the order is the spirit of the thousand-armed, 11-headed Avalokiteshvara. So this is really the final and secret teaching of what it is to practice the Bodhisattva ideal. It's not merely a question of what you do in your meditation. It's not merely a question of what you do in your own work with yourself, work on your own mind. It's not that merely at all. If it's merely those things, it can only go so far. And then it circles back on itself. It's participating in Sangha as fully and deeply as you can. And Sangha in this full and rich sense of reaching inwards, reaching outwards. I like very much the metaphor of breathing in and breathing out. The bodhicitta breathes in and breathes out. You saw this in the Tonglen practice, the breathing in of the pain and suffering of the world and the evil of the world, transforming it and breathing it out as blessings, as purifying white light. This is what the whole order is engaged in. It's engaged in breathing in human beings, all beings, effectively, if we can, breathing them in so that if they want to, they can transform themselves, and then breathing out the spirit of bodhicitta to more and more individuals, trying to make the bodhicitta affect the wider group. But it's very, very important that we realize, as an individual, you can only have a very limited effect upon the world. You need to participate in something that exemplifies the transformation that you're trying to communicate to people, and you need the support of that. Somebody was telling me, Vajranatha was telling me that he's working in Venezuela, and very, very difficult. They've been through a very tough time. Difficulties emerged in the Sangha, which were very, very painful, and the Sangha is a little bit, scarred, as it were, by that. So he says, you know, he's working on his own as best he can. But he said that as soon as another order member comes, he can manifest something that he just can't manifest on his own. He can only manifest it to some degree. He can only talk about it. But he said as soon as another order member comes, it's not merely that they have it between them, but that everybody on the retreat has it. They get it. They participate in it. They're transformed by it. So this is the understanding at its deepest level of what you're trying to do in joining the order. And I hope that you grasp this and that you really understand that in asking to join the order, you're asking to be part of this. You want to be part of it, even that you already are part of it, because you are. Wherever you stand in this process, you're already part of it, but you want to move deeper and deeper into it and have a more powerful effect in making that breathing in and out as transformative as possible. So I hope this vision can be easily connected for you with the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. As I say, it's a bit like a, you know, one of those simplified anatomical sketches of the inner dimension of Avalokiteshvara, and how that reflected in our order. So, brothers, I really hope that you do want to commit yourselves much more deeply to this process, because I believe we need the spirit of bodhicitta acted out in the world as never before. Of course, it's always been needed, but I think the world is in some ways better than it's ever been, and in some ways far worse. It's certainly more dangerous than it's ever been because of the destructive power of our modern technology, destructive in so many different ways. So I personally feel that it's this participation in this Bodhisattva life through my membership of the order that is my attempt as a tiny little individual to contribute to something far greater than me, and that I will pass on to others. I feel this at my stage in life. I'm 70. I'm still in good health, but inevitably at 70, you know, you see the writings on the wall, as it were. It's getting closer. Well, it is actually for every one of us, but by definition it's getting closer. But it's more obviously getting closer for me than it is for those who are younger. But I feel no despair from a personal point of view or from a collective point of view, because I feel that very strongly that this spirit of bodhicitta is alive. It's alive in our order, that it is manifested in it, for all our utter stupidity at times, and the foolish things that we do and say to each other. Nonetheless, I'm absolutely confident in the bodhicitta as manifesting amongst us, and I'm quite convinced that that will not be lost. And so I look upon my own not being immediately part of it with complete equanimity. I'm completely confident that my tiny contribution to it will not have been wasted, that it will go on, and that, you know, when I come back, one of you will be my teacher and will help me to reconnect with that spirit. So I feel a very deep confidence in what we're collectively doing. And I'm very sure that many of you will contribute to it and continue it into the future. So thank you so much for listening to me, because as you can imagine, in talking about these things to you, I'm giving expression to some of my most deeply cherished values. And when I can communicate them to you, to the extent that I can communicate them to you, I experience them more deeply. And I have felt very much in contact with them during these days. So thank you.
The applause is eloquent. Thank you. And of course, we can express even more, if that's possible, appreciation and support tomorrow, because we have the question and answer session tomorrow. But thank you very, very much for, not just a wonderful talk on the actual living out of the bodhicitta, but Well, that was a What is the Order talk as well. Thank you very much.